Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who knows that the Pirates do everything. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and we watched the VeggieTales growing up.
We sure did, and I'm sure there are some people that appreciated that reference, but most importantly, I think Pirates fans could not be more excited on this Monday morning, April 24th, with their team in first place. Of course, we're going to talk about the Moppin' Buccos. We are going to talk about the weekend that was. We're going to talk about Vlad Jr. and his distaste for the New York Yankees. What the hell is wrong with the Cardinals? Pursuits of perfect games that end in funny fashion. And of course, Drew Maggi. But Jake, tell us. First of all, how was your weekend? That's probably a good place. So how are you? You doing all right, man? You good?
I'm good. I slept through my alarm this morning, but you know, I am a beast. And so I hopped right back up and started recording this podcast. How about
love
you?
Love that. Love that determination.
People can't touch me. Let's talk about the Pirates. Enough about us. The Pittsburgh Pirates of PNC Park, a stadium which I believe, Jordan, we should start calling the Pirate Bay. Which is funny.
Okay, that's good. I mean, I'm sure there have been different nicknames for that over the years, but now it's like, hey, we're paying attention. You got more pressure to come up with a nickname.
And we are illegally downloading tons of wins. They are 16-7. They are first place in the NL Central. And most notably, they have an 11.9% chance to make the postseason, which is as high as that number has been in a long time. So we're going to spend a little bit of time today trying to understand, one, why have the Pirates been good? Two, are they actually good? Jordan, where would you like to start?
I think let's start with how they got here, okay? Because 16-7 is not, and by the way, they've won, you know, seven in a row here coming into Monday, including a mop of the Reds, our second mop of the season, four-game sweep. That is a mop. They did it at home at the Pirate Bay, as you called it. I know the Reds are struggling, but hey, a mop is a mop, and you deserve the credit for it. So what has gone right? Forget about projecting forward. Let's just enjoy what has been so great for the Buccos so far. And it starts with at an obvious place. Connor Joe.
Of course.
Connor Joe, who much was made of, you know, Andrew McCutchen returning to Pittsburgh after a long stint away at all these places that he didn't call home. He always had Pittsburgh home. But no, who was the Pirates' first rounder, their 39th overall pick in 2014? It was Connor Joe out of the University of San Diego. And so far, Connor Joe has been the most impactful player out of the University of San Diego, edging out Chris Bryan and Paul Sewald so far. This man has an OPS over 1,000. This man is getting on base. He is not striking out. And him, along with Jack Sawinski, and Brian Reynolds, have created one of the most productive outfields in the entire league. Yes, Connor Joe, Jack Sawinski, and Brian Reynolds. And that is quite a revelation. Now, Connor Joe, as a player, has been interesting because he's been passed around different organizations who look at his minor league numbers and think, this has got to translate at some point. And now it finally starting to happen for him. And it's pretty cool to see it to happen with him in his old organization. And we'll talk about Andrew McCutchen in a second. But yeah, Connor Joe and Jack Sawinski, that's a good place to start.
Jack Sawinski in the 96th percentile of average exit velocity, 98th percentile of barrel rate, and 96th percentile of walk rate in baseball. He is still only 24 years old. He was a 15th round pick out of a Chicago area high school. So this is the type of player who has a lot of developmental meat left on the bone. This is looking pretty good.
Let's also remember how they got him. They got him for Adam Frazier. And, you know, the Pirates have made many a trades over the last decade that they have gotten ridiculed for. And, you know, I think justifiably so with a lot of them. But getting Jack Sawinski, who, yes, he is going to strike out a lot, but this is real juice. He hit 19 home runs last year as a rookie in 106 games, and nobody really noticed. He was striking out a ton, but like, this is real pop here, and that's clearly continuing to translate. And that has really changed the complexion, because when we came into the season, we looked at this lineup and we saw this mishmash of young, unproven players who we were excited about and veterans who seemed to be brought in to be babysitters, and then a pitching staff that similar, very similar, but even maybe less that you could count on. But the offense that they've had so far has really been what has impressed me. And if Sawinski, I mean, Connor Joe's 30, right? So maybe he is a full-blown reclamation project or someone that is a late bloomer that is going to become an above-average major league hitter consistently. But Sawinski at 24, like, you might actually have some kind of building block here. And that's important because of a couple obvious points about the Pirates so far. One, O'Neill Cruz had a horrible injury and is not playing for the next several months. And that was the reason we thought we were going to be tuning into the Pirates. And two, to put it bluntly, Ke'Bryan Hayes is still smashing the ball into the ground and cannot seem to figure out how to translate his hard hit rates into power production. And that leaves an offensive gap where you need less heralded players like Sawinski, like Rodolfo Castro, who's been awesome, to really step up. So that's what's impressed me so far. But who else has stood out to you?
Well, the last thing I want to say about their offense, Andrew McCutchen is not cooked. Watching Andrew McCutchen interact with the 2023 Pirates is so enjoyable. Like putting his arm around Ji-Won Bae, you know, picking up Ke'Bryan Hayes after a strikeout, you know, talking about old people stuff with Carlos Santana. Seeing him interact with this world is really a pure joy experience. And it makes it even better that he's freaking raking, right? He said when he signed here, he was not coming here to retire for like a goodbye tour. He was coming here to play and to win baseball games. And we kind of laughed at that a little bit. But guess what? I mean, he's got a 144 OPS plus at 36 years old and the Pirates are 16-7. So I'll tip my cap to him. Anything from the rotation you want to talk about?
Well, also you mentioned, you know, the hanging out with the old folks. Carlos Santana, what a delight. Now, he's brought in two, obviously, I just experienced this. He's a legitimately massive reason why the Mariners made the postseason last year, both on and off the field. But he is clearly doing exactly what they could have hoped. Sure, it was easy to joke, oh, he's just there to kind of, you know, keep O'Neill Cruz in line. But I feel like it's so much more than that. Like, Carlos Santana is not there to lose. Like, that is, and sure, you can laugh at that. And when he signed there, it's not like you expected them to be 16-7. But these guys can have an impact, and he's playing well. And so that is a combination that clearly can have an impact on the entire team, not just, you know, his at-bats. But that's been huge, too, because, you know, Choi's already hurt, and having Cruz out and having Hayes after a slow start, like, you are going to need contributions on offense. As for the pitching,
it's been hilariously competent.
Well, hilariously competent. Yesterday, we got an unbelievable performance from Vince Velasquez. I should note a truly ridiculous outing from him. But you know, Rich Hill was looking really bad to start the year and is still, I'm not super confident that he's gonna, you know, hang on all season long, but he's had some good starts in there. I think the most surprising development, I'm not surprised Mitch Keller's just been solid, good, normal, looking like a really solid mid-rotation starter, which is great. But it's been Johan Oviedo looking a lot better than Roansy Contreras. And I remember when Oviedo made his debut with the Cardinals, and I was like, I didn't know a ton about him. He was a guy who kind of signed late out of Cuba with the Cardinals and kind of went through the minors. And when he showed up, I was like, damn, this dude's got crazy stuff. This is in 2020. His numbers weren't great. But you watch him now, and they've really made some tweaks there with him that are really impressive. And, you know, Roansy's been pretty good too, but Oviedo's the one that we were not necessarily counting on. I remember coming out of camp, I was expecting and hoping that Luis Ortiz, who kind of blew us away last year, was going to get that last spot. Instead, they gave it to Oviedo, and he's been tremendous. So if the Pirates can be developed, again, same thing with the Orioles. We've drawn this parallel before. If you can find a way to improve your pitching better than what those names suggest, that's a very fast way to competency, let alone, you know, being 16-7 in the first place.
And the bullpen's been great. Bednar, yeah, David Bednar is legit. Mm-hmm. Colin Holderman, who they got from the Mets last year for
Vogelback.
That was for Vogelback, right? Yep. Yeah, he's been great. And then Dwayne Underwood Jr. is a very fun watch out of the pen. Highly recommend him when he's on. But those are the Pirates. Now, are they real? I think they're 2023 Orioles level of real, where they're real, but they're not real, if that makes sense.
I agree, except unlike the 2022 Orioles, they have the NL Central to compete against as opposed to the AL East, which is, of course, what made the Orioles second half last year so amazing, is they were going up against these awesome teams. And sure, more of a balanced schedule. You're not playing these teams as often. But like, we'll get to the Cardinals here in a little bit. Like, they're a bit of a mess. The Brewers look awesome. I know there's Brewers fans listening to this being like, what the fuck, guys? Like, we're killing it too. And maybe just because you just got your ass kicked on Sunday and it's recency bias, but the Pirates are the ones in first place. but I think that will help them to kind of stick around. But listen, the Cruz injury sucks. Like, there's still things missing here, and the pitching, there's still parts of this pitching staff that I'm very sketchy on, including both Vince Velasquez and Rich Hill. And you know, you could see some of these younger pitchers, particularly with Contreras and Oviedo, who haven't had big workloads, see how they carry it over into the second half, because right now they're fresh and that's great, but that's where the staying power is kind of questionable. But I don't know, man, like 11% chance to make the playoffs, I guess that sounds about right. That might still sound a little optimistic, but I think they have enough right going for them and enough of those young players that look solid that they'll probably be right around 500, maybe a little bit below.
Call up Tamar Johnson, Jordan. Just do it. He's why ready. Wait?
Why wait? Why wait? Just bring him up. Yeah, just have him leapfrog Henry Davis and Andy Rodriguez and all those great guys. Just Tamar straight to the show. Seems like a good plan.
So now that we've talked about the Pirates, let's talk about the other big market teams and run you through the weekend that was in baseball. The Pirates over the Reds. That was the only mop, the only four-game sweep that we had. We did have three other three-game sweeps. The Astros over the Braves in Atlanta. Just an absolute bang, bang, bang. Got him. See ya. Thanks for coming out. Close game on Sunday. That was an entertaining series. Rays over the White Sox. The Rays just sweep people. That's just what they do now. And the Orioles over the Tigers in a you better sweep this one kind of series, including a hilarious walk-off win on Sunday. The Mets and Giants split a four-game series. That was a Sunday night game. The Mets finishing their West Coast swing against San Diego, the Dodgers, and the Giants 7-3 before they head home to play the Nats on Tuesday. It's a nice, the vibes in Queens are pretty good right now. Dodgers taking 3-4 over the Cubs. The Padres 3-4 with Tatis back over the Diamondbacks in Arizona. And the Phillies kind of getting right a little bit, taking 3-4 over the Rockies, even though those were all closer games, longer into the games than any Phillies fan would have liked. Texas taking 2-3 over the A's, who got a win. Congratulations to the Oakland A's. It's a good day in Oakland, Jordan. The A's got a win.
Great day.
Adelis Garcia with an absolute ridiculous game in that series. I believe he had 5 extra base hits. Blue Jays over the Yankees in the Bronx, winning 5-1 on Sunday to take that series. Yankees got a DJ LeMahieu walk-off single on Saturday. Mariners 2-3 over the Cardinals. Red Sox 2-3 over the Brewers, even though Rowdy Tellez just absolutely terrorized Boston all weekend. Miami playing some good ball, the Marlins are 2-3 over the Guardians. That was a funny series because every time Luis Arraez came up, I'd be like, you should just be on Cleveland. Like, why are you not on the Guardians?
Stephen
like,
Kwan was thinking the same thing.
They were just like hanging out. The Nats taking 2-3 over the Twins. Worried about my Twinkies. Not looking great. And the Angels winning a series over the Royals. And they would have swept as well if not for a Jose Quijada implosion on a awful, awful loss on Saturday. So, Jordan, we've talked about the Buccos. That's everything that happened over the weekend. Where do you want to hop in?
Well, let's quickly rate the Sunday night baseball game. This was really the main one of this series that I watched. But yeah, Mets-Giants, this was solid. This was a nice little showing. As you mentioned, the Mets at the end of a long road trip. And the Giants, who record-wise is nothing impressive, and yet you look at their stats and you're like, okay. And they ultimately pull out this one to get the split. But yeah, what stood out to you about this game? I thought this was an above-average Sunday night baseball game. We got the David Cohn rosin experiment, which was interesting. I thought that was a nice little look, and I appreciated. I'm not surprised that David Cohn would be someone to push to kind of show that on national TV. That's really important. Like that's a really good thing for him to be able to do, to give to a national audience that isn't necessarily going to be paying attention. And if you didn't see it, basically he was showing that the rubbing alcohol that they claimed that the league told Max Scherzer to use, or Scherzer said to use to clean it off, actually made it worse, depending on the sweat and depending on the humidity and whatever. Now, you had mentioned when we talked about it last week that was something that can help get sticky stuff off, and I'm sure it can, but I think if there's one thing we learned about the Scherzer thing is that sweat and rosin is going to be different in a lot of different situations, and there's going to be a lot of different chemical reactions, and that results in a sticky situation.
Sounds like you need a chemist, Jordan.
Yeah, maybe I'll try to find one. We'll see.
If you could just marry a chemist really quick, that'd be great.
All right, I'll do my best. Thanks,
dude. Other things that stand out from this game, Jock Peterson scoring on an RBI double, I believe, late in the game, and just tumbling his way onto home plate. An absolutely awful slide from Jock Peterson, falling ass first over home plate. Great example of like inbox athlete is Jock Peterson at this point in his career.
Oh, yeah. But hey, that's where he needs to be an athlete, and it is working. He continues to rake.
And then Brandon Nimmo had the mic on at one point early in this game, and they were interviewing him from the booth, which I know a lot of people like get stressed out when they see that, and I think those people need to chill and like mix in a weed gummy. These are adults, like they're fine. They're professional baseball players. It's okay. And Nimmo was surprisingly entertaining. And he's just a very fascinating type of baseball man where like he's always smiling. He always is having a good time. He never really says anything particularly compelling, but he does seem like the type of person who is like, at least you feel decently good after you hear him talk. And he had a very interesting story to tell about growing up in Wyoming and riding horses and what baseball was like in Wyoming. So I always like it when that interview goes relatively well on the broadcast. Anything else from that game, Jordan?
Yeah, two other quick things. The Francisco Alvarez home run, his first of the season, was just a very funny aesthetic home run because it was off like a 73-mile-an-hour Tyler Rogers goofy curveball. But, you know, that's what you're want. That's a glimpse. I know the Mets lost this game, but this is another important glimpse. You know, Francisco Alvarez clearly going to need to be very important for this team. So that was cool. And then Doval. I mean, Doval is amazing. Doval is at the end there. Like, I know we have a lot of guys throwing hard, but just the kind of swings he was getting was nuts. So it might be wasted on this Giants team. They are already in quite a hole. But like we said, you know, there's some things going well for them. I just am skeptical they're really going to be a factor in the postseason mix.
What a weird mix. They should see if Bonds is available.
Yeah, that really would add some thump there. Let's talk about a couple other series before we head to break that caught my attention. I wanted to talk about Houston's sweep over Atlanta. That's one I wrote a little bit about it at Fox, which you can read right now. Yordan Alvarez had three hits in this series, only three hits. On Friday, we had a go-ahead home run in the ninth. On Saturday, we had a go-ahead home run in the sixth. And then on Sunday, we had a game-tying single with two outs, bases loaded in the top of the eighth to, of course, tie the game. Corey Jolks eventually has the pinch hit go-ahead single. And the Astros, he had five hits on the weekend. Corey Jolks, that's a name. It's not quite James Outman, but I'm just telling you now, you should familiarize yourself with Corey Jolks because he is in the same category of destroyed the upper minors and nobody gave a shit. And now he's in the big leagues. And let's not be super shocked if he can actually hit a little bit. But Yordan with his three big swings. And the most notable thing from this weekend or from this series is that the Astros bullpen threw a no-hitter over the course of the weekend. 9 1/3 innings hitless following the Hunter Brown, Framber Valdez, and Christian Javier starts. And as I wrote at Fox, that's the Astros. I know they're only 12-10 now, but that's the Astros that we've been waiting to see. There are still parts of this team that are not quite complete. Jose Abreu continues to struggle. But as long as Yordan's killing it, Kyle Tucker looks fantastic. Bregman's slowly starting to heat up. They're going to be just fine. However, huge series coming up with them this week. Three games at the Trop. Remember, the Rays have still not been defeated at home. I would like to think that the Astros will have something to say about that in the next 3 days.
Kind of a rough showing from Atlanta's bullpen, which had showed out pretty well so far this year. AJ Minter, Nick Anderson, Kirby Yates, you know, maybe they need a little nap. Again, it is small sample size. Bullpen is always weird, but the Nick Anderson experience may be a little bit more smoke and mirrors than we thought.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But again, I think I didn't come out of this worried about Atlanta. I just came away from this just more impressed with Houston and seeing what they were able to do. You would think like, they're 9-10 and now have to go play one of the best teams in the league. And they're like, that's fine. Actually, we're cool. We're just going to sweep them.
Yeah. Raisel Iglesias should be off the IL, I think, relatively soon. So they will have a closer back in the fold. Jordan, you are a Mariners fan. You watch a lot of the Mariners. The Mariners beat the Cardinals 2-3. The Cardinals are one of the more perplexing teams so far this year. You watched them pretty closely over the weekend. What were your takeaways?
Yeah, you know, both going into this weekend, 8-11, both fan bases clearly in an uneasy state. And it was a classic case where Mariners win the series but lose on Sunday. Losing on Sunday, no matter, even if you win the series, is just the worst, because then you completely forget about the two games you won before and you just feel like shit. At the same time, the Cardinals now are 9-13. And it was just like their pitching. Like, listen, we knew the pitching was going to be underwhelming. But just when you see the performances from Michaelis, again, whose ERA is still over 7, and Mats, and the bullpen right now with Verhagen, and obviously Hicks is just totally out of the mix, but Genesis Cabrera, and it is just not an imposing group. And the issue is that while some of their younger players are showing up, right, Gorman has been amazing, and Jordan Walker, he's cooled off a little bit, but he's been solid. Burleson good, but Arenado is really, really not looking good. That is the one that stood out to me. Just some really poor swings and some really just uncompetitive at-bats from someone that you could really pencil in. I know he's hitting 284, but it does not look like it. Like, I don't think he's hurt or anything, but he just looked off in a big way. Wilson Contreras is heating up, so that's good, but they're going to have to outscore their pitching, and I'm not feeling super awesome about that right now. That would be where I'm at with the Cardinals. And the Mariners, like, yeah, they won the series. They had some good moments. Kelnick's real, dude. Like, the homers he's hitting now, these opposite field home runs, he had two opposite field home runs this weekend, one on a fastball in and the second on a breaking ball in. Like, those are the individual swings where it's like, this isn't a small sample. It's like, there's only so many people that can do that. And if he's executing that in game, then yeah, he's a different hitter. Like, he is confident he is going to be an awesome hitter for them. And I just don't know how much longer they're going to hit him 6th and 7th. Like, honestly, like, I would be hitting him 5th at this point, ahead of Raleigh, maybe even ahead of Teoscar. Teoscar's also been awesome. So some signs of encouragement for the Mariners as well. But yeah, there's definitely problems with both of these teams still.
Kelnick, remember, he is like younger than Royce Lewis. He's only 23 years old. He's younger than Oswaldo Cabrera. He's younger than a lot of these, you know, top prospects who are going to come up this year and perform in the big leagues. He is a child, and he didn't look good as a 21 and 22 year old, because neither did we in our lives, and neither did you, listener, in your lives. And giving Kelnick the time and the patience to turn into what he was supposed to turn into, that's really important. And people, I saw some people being like, should the Mariners capitalize on this and trade him now before it goes wrong? Like, no, like, he is this, like, this is it. Okay. Like, why would they trade this?
Yeah. Also, like, they need him. He's been the most steady guy that they've had, because Julio has been off to a relatively slow start. So he's been so important and so impressive. And yeah, it's just been really cool to see, because it's not that people rule him out, but like, when you're that bad, it's hard to imagine jumping to being this good, right? I think most Mariners fans were like, oh, like, let's just see him be above average, you know, hit righties pretty well, maybe hit 24 home runs, hit 7th, let the rest of the team do the heavy lifting. And instead he's like, actually, I'll just be the best hitter. It's like, all right, that works too. No complaints. So that was very impressive as well.
Last thing I want to talk about. Oh, yeah. Let's talk about Shane McClanahan. Oh, so yeah. McClanahan threw on Saturday.
Oh, yeah. Sure did.
Against the White Sox. And threw is a good way to describe it. You know, this is what we call the Cespedes Family Barbecue Baseball Barbercast bump. You know, he comes on the pod. And what does he do, Jordan? 88 pitches, 32 whiffs.
32 whiffs, which was, I don't know. I know it was a record through, I think, the 6 innings. And then he went back out. I know he only ended up pitching, I believe, 88 pitches. But that is just for the, because I we're still getting used to that as like a common stat that you're tracking. And you're so just for general reference, a starting pitcher getting like 20 whiffs in a game is
great.
Ridiculously good. That's like a great outing. If you're getting 20 swings and misses in a start, that is awesome. 15 is like solid. 10 or less, like, they're seeing you pretty well, right? That's generally the framework that we're working with, the rubric, right? 32 is, I mean, that's like, it's unheard of. You've only seen 30 plus in the game a handful of times. And, you know, the White Sox, here's the thing about the White Sox. They like to swing.
It's a good matchup. They sure like to swing. Good matchup.
They sure like to swing. But also, I mean, it's not terrible hitters either. You know, I know that they've been the one AL Central team that actually has hit a little bit. And I mean, 32 swings and misses on 88 pitches is outrageous.
My favorite part of this is that 4 days earlier, Shane McClanahan came on our podcast and we asked him, it's more complicated than you just trying to blow hitters away, right? And he said, yes, it's much more complicated. And then he went out there in his next start and simply blew hitters away.
But I'll push back on that a little bit. You watch those 32 swings and misses. It's a lot of off speed, man. The changeup was insane. Insane. And like, that's the pitch that he's only like sort of started to figure out over the last couple of years. And it was just, and that's the talk about matchup against that righty heavy lineup, against Robert and against, you know, Sheets and, or sorry, Sheets is a lefty, but against Vaughn and some of those guys.
Eloy.
Just like, Eloy, right. Just, oh my goodness. So Shane's amazing. He should also, by the way, we should say, I know we talked last week about how Gerrit Cole and Luis Castillo are kind of in their own category. Shane McClanahan is very much in that discussion, as is that Jacob deGrom fella, who we must remind everybody is indeed in the American League now.
Gerrit Cole did do it again, by the way.
Yeah.
He did it again. He's up to 2 war. I know pitcher war is stupid and silly, but he has thrown 34 innings and he has allowed, I believe, 3 runs. Mm-hmm. He has struck out 36 guys in 34 innings. He has been incredible. And most importantly, we'll say this every week, he has yet to allow a home run. Even more impressive when you consider that of his 5 starts, 4 of them have been in Yankee Stadium, which I understand is more of a pitcher's park than people think, but you can fluke one out to right, trust me. And he won that game on Saturday against a very good Blue Jays lineup. Alek Manoah looking a lot better in that start. I know they ended up losing that game, but he was pretty solid going 7 innings. This is a great Alek Manoah line. 7 innings, 2 hits, 1 walk, 5 Ks, right? Who needs the punchies? Cole was a little less sharp, I think, than he'd been. Only struck out 4 and 5 2/3, which for him is not a lot. Needed a little bit more higher pitch count than usual, but a win's a win for him. I know he didn't get the win, but the Yankees won that game on the walk-off.
Also, like, Jay's lineup is legit. So, you know, that's still coming out of that game with a win was impressive. After the break, we will talk a little bit about Vlad Jr. against the Yankees. But before we head to break, any other series that you did want to highlight? I mean, I think those, yeah, we hit them up. I mean, the Orioles, hey, man, like, on one hand, it's like it's the Tigers. You should sweep them. Definitely maybe some closer games than you would have expected, but still
this
impressive.
Is the thing. And I was thinking about this with the Pirates too. Like, people saying, oh, they're sweeping the bad teams. Like, what do we? Well, that means they're not one.
Exactly.
Right? Like,
exactly.
For the last handful of years, the Orioles and the Pirates were one of the bad teams that you were supposed to sweep, right? Or supposed to beat 2 out of 3. And so if they're going from that to the team that's picking up these easy wins, that's notable. Even if they're not like sweeping the Astros, right? They're still winning the games they're supposed to win. And that's how you end up with 85 wins at the end of the year.
And you have to think about the opposite of that feeling, which is what Twins fans are feeling on this Monday morning. When you have the Nationals coming into town for 3, in your head, when you're already in first place, you're like, hell yeah, let's find some momentum, the way that the Rangers went into the weekend against Oakland and were like, great, we can extend our lead even more in the division because we got the A's. Instead, the Twins, you know, dropping a series to the Nationals is just like, that is like the kind of stuff that is as maddening as it gets, because while again, as we've learned, I mean, Oakland won on Friday, right? Any of these teams can't win any of these games. If you want to stay in a good position in the standings, you do have to take care of business. That is obvious.
My man, Edouard Julien, the Canadian crusher, sent back down to AAA. He had 1 walk and 9 strikeouts, which is the opposite of what he was doing in the minor leagues. Probably a little bit too aggressive. But yeah, the Twins lineup right now is a disaster. Nick Gordon, friend of the show, rocking a negative 24 OPS plus is certainly not what you want. Negative 24 OPS
Dude.
Plus.
They have, I think, a bottom 5 OPS in it got a little bit better against the Nationals. So, I mean, 682 OPS, 94 OPS plus is bad, but like that is a rough watch. And most notably, we sort of noticed this a couple weeks in, they still have only one steal. And I know that it's like, come on, guys.
Let's go.
Read the room.
Go.
So that is troubling, to say the least. And their pitching's keeping them in it, which is very bizarre. But
Byron Buxton, zero steals. That's a good thing. Don't let him run at all.
That's true. We can find other guys to run. All right, Jake, let's take a break. And when we return, we'll talk Vlad versus the Yankees, Drew Smyly and Yan Gomes' piggyback attempt, and Drew Maggi and more.
Hey, everybody. I'm James Hinchcliffe.
And I'm Alexander Rossi. And we're the hosts of Off Track with Hinch and Rossi.
The racing season is in full swing, and we're breaking down all the exciting action on and off the track from the world of IndyCar, NASCAR, Formula One, and more.
And by more, we mean that sometimes we just talk about whatever the hell we want, like time travel, Canadian ships, or the many reasons not to go to Death Valley. Either way, join us. Every week, we'll be here having fun.
Fun's a relative term, but that's not the point. Download Off Track with Hinch and Rossi on Apple, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Let's talk about Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s promise, his assertion that he will never wear the pinstripes and never play for the New York Yankees. The Blue Jays were in the Bronx over the weekend, and Guerrero was asked about comments he had over the winter with a radio host, El Dottor Nastra, where he said that he likes to play in New York. I like to kill the Yankees. I would never sign with the Yankees, not even when I'm dead. Woo. And he reiterated it. Like, they asked him again. And he said, yeah, no, it's a personal family thing. Like, I will never change that.
We had a recent discussion when we talked about Ohtani in New York about the concept of future Yankee and how Yankees fans, whenever a very talented player comes to town, they assume, oh, he'll be a Yankee one day when he's done with his piddly little franchise in some other small-time city. He'll come play for the real baseball team up here in the Bronx. And Vlad Jr. has heard some of that and has said, not even when I'm dead. Now, he said that over the winter, and then he doubled down this weekend, hits two home runs against the Yankees.
Yep, two home runs against the Yankees. He always crushes the Yankees, always plays well in the Bronx. Quick thing is, like, great example of when Latin players, this happens sometimes, like, they are doing interviews in media and saying things over the offseason or to, you know, Spanish-speaking reporters that us, the gringo world, we don't pick up on and we don't make necessarily a big deal out of because we miss it because we're dumb and we don't speak Spanish. And, like, Vlad said this over the winter on a radio show in Spanish, presumably, and, like, everyone kind of missed it. I understand that it was picked up enough that he got asked about it in the Bronx, but just a reminder that even if it's not said in English through a translator, a lot of the biggest, best players of baseball are saying and doing interesting things that us dum-dums can't understand.
Yeah, I think that's true. But also, let's just talk about the actual concept here. Not the only one. I mean, this was a famous thing going back to Ken Griffey Jr. I know people were making that kind of connection. Obviously, different dynastic families. But first of all, it's just hilarious. It's great. It's the kind of beef that is in some ways completely harmless and in other ways just like perfect to bother Yankees fans because Vlad Jr. is already a pain in the ass for them to have to deal with. And now you know how personal it is for them for some reason, which again, do we know the exact details, the exact things related to, I assume, his dad to some degree? But it's fine. I'm not sure it's really our business and I'm not really sure I care. I just love that. I know some people are trying to figure it out. It's like, no, like he clearly feels strongly enough about it to double down and to be like, yes, I did mean that. And that's enough for me.
It could be as harmless as, like, you know, Yankees suck child behavior, and it could be as meaningful as fan was offensive to his dad, right? It could be anywhere in between those, and there's no point in speculating. Maybe it'll come out at some point, maybe it won't. What I want to do is I want to throw some ideas around about why, you know, some funny ideas around why does he not want to play there? Do you think it has something to do with the taxes? Is it the public transit system? Does he hate Eric Adams? He's against his policies. What do you think it is?
No roof. No roof on Yankee Stadium is something that I am sure he's gotten very comfortable with.
The pinstripes are too slimming. He wants to be seen as imposing.
That's the thing. Yeah, because like he's kind of, I know he's slimmed down in some ways, but also like he's still Vlad Jr. Like he's got to be coming in with some heft, and we don't want them to be slimming. We want him to look like the beast that he is.
He doesn't want to cut his hair. I mean, that's probably
a layup. Yeah, I have to imagine that's something that, I mean, you got to go back to, man, when he signed, I think, to the last time he did not have his hair like that. So yeah, that's probably a good reason. I'm trying to think of anyone. I mean, like to me, like it could be as simple as, you know, we're thinking about it from the standpoint of how much he doesn't want to play for the Yankees. But I think it's as much about he loves playing against the Yankees so much that he would only have that opportunity, you know, on the backfields in Tampa. Like, that's not as fun as homering against Garrett Cole or whatever in Yankee Stadium as the opponent. Like, that just, the upside there is just much lower, I feel like.
I love that he said this. I think it's awesome. Yeah, it's great. Like, so many baseball people don't like the Yankees, and to have a player just say it against his own benefit, you know, let's say Vlad does make it to free agency, and we can talk about his future in a second. Essentially just crossing out one whole enormous big market team from the conversation probably costs him like a million or two, and he's like, I don't care.
It makes me wonder if it helps him in his negotiations with the Blue Jays from the standpoint of an extension or something like that. And, you know, he's still a few more years from free agency. I know they did manage to, you know, extend Bo at least through arbitration and stuff, but This is also, let's just allow this to pivot to just Vlad right now as a player. I mean, he looks amazing. And the biggest difference about Vlad so far this year is not just that he's elevating the ball, which is something that has kind of fluctuated over the last couple of seasons. He's not striking out anymore. The contact rate has now reached a really impressive level. He has the same number of walks and strikeouts. Not that he was striking out a ton before. I mean, he only struck out, you know, 110 times in 2021, 116 times in 2022, and that's playing every single game, basically. But, like, if he's going to lower that even more, this dude's unbelievable. And that's the whole point of Vlad. When we have talked about him since he was 17, it's because he can be the best hitter in baseball, right? And so if he's going to cut down on that, that is something that can separate him from the Yordan Alvarezes of the world. Because while Yordan right now has a really strong case for you know, best hitter in the league, and you could say the same thing about Trout, right? Those guys are still striking out a ton. And so if Vlad can actually combine super duper elite contact rates with the power that we saw from him in 2021, now we're having a conversation about him again as the best hitter in the league.
And he's also probably the last of the young, incredible players who has not signed an extension. He's the obvious glaring one. Mm-hmm. I know Adley Rutschman hasn't signed one. You could talk about Randy Arozarena. Doesn't have an extension.
He's older,
right? Yeah. Like, if you're really buying Jared Kelnick, I guess, like, that's another one, right? But Vlad is kind of in his own category there of elite young player who is not locked up. He becomes a free agent.
I mean, Soto's also still in that conversation. But,
I don't know how I forgot.
Still the same age.
I know.
But yes. I'm fascinated.
Yeah, those two are the guys. Like, mm-hmm. Vlad is a free agent after 25, mm-hmm. I believe. So that's this year, next year, and the following. He's going to need, like, I would imagine it'll be like what Miggy got when he signed his extension. Like, it'll be in that range plus inflation plus, you know, the adjustment for where the market's gone. He is he's a defensive nothing, but he is, like, legitimately one of the best hitters in the world.
He's a damn good first baseman, and that is not nothing. I honestly mean that. I know he's not, you know, necessarily out there, you know, playing center, but honestly, dude, are you telling me he's giving me less defensive value than Soto? Because I'm not sure I believe that at this point.
I know.
Soto, bad corner outfield versus Vlad, good first baseman.
I don't
defense?
Think he's a good first baseman.
Okay, I do. I think he's a good first baseman. I know that some of the numbers say that he's good and some of the numbers say he's bad. I think he's good, but again, like, all right, first base defense is not something that the metrics are always going to encapsulate. But again, we can, that's not why he's signing an extension. It doesn't matter. If he's the best hitter in the world, who cares? But it's good. I'm glad we found something we disagree on of Vlad's first base defense. anyway, let's move on. We love Vlad Jr. He's great. Let's move on to two perfect game pursuits over the weekend. One happened on Friday afternoon. Great time for that. We had talked on the Friday morning pod about James Outman, who had delivered this incredible blow against the Cubs on Thursday night, and how excited we were for this Cubs-Dodgers series to be packed, for Wrigley Field to be bumping, to have that Friday afternoon game, that classic afternoon at Wrigley on Friday where it's the only game on. And I had it on, and the Cubs were whooping them, absolutely kicking the Dodgers' ass. And then I look up in the fifth or the sixth, and I actually had turned the game off. I had switched over to college baseball. I was like, don't need to watch this anymore. I opened up Twitter and I saw, oh, actually, that game I had been watching the whole time, you didn't notice that Drew Smyly had a perfect game. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess I will turn that game back on then. Jake, what was your experience watching this perfect game effort before we get to how it concluded?
So I hopped in the sixth inning, and I hopped in from the Toronto Blue Jays road clubhouse at Yankee Stadium. And the game was on the television inside the clubhouse, and the score was like 13-0. And I was very confused. I had not watched the game. I did not know it was a perfect game. Kevin Biggio, Bo Bichette, and Danny Jansen of the Blue Jays were like parked on the couch watching intently. And I was like, huh? Like, what? Like, why? Like, this is a blowout. Why are you watching? And I went up to them and I was like, what's up, guys? Like, quick question for you. You know, 13-0 game. Do you think there would ever be like a mercy rule? Like, you guys would ever be down to have a mercy rule in the bigs? Like, do you think that's something that could ever happen? I asked them this because I assumed, like, you know, they're just watching this 13-0 game. And they like answered the question. You know, they gave some interesting thoughts and they were like, yeah, but like in this case, you know, this is a perfect game. I was like, this is a perfect game? They're like, yeah, dude, it's a perfect game.
That's good. I'm glad that they have no, superstitious qualms of being like, yeah, but not this one. Cause they're like, no, perfect game. Which, by the way, I think we've made so much progress in that arena. I know some fans disagreed on this, but like I had, of course, the Cubs broadcast on through six, you know, Boog Ciambi, Jim Deshays, and I think Girardi was actually in the booth for this as well. They're like, perfect game, perfect game, perfect game, perfect game, perfect game. I'm like, great. Now,
love it.
Is that why what happened in the top of the eighth happened? No, it's not. But boy, was it funny. So were you watching when it ended or how did that go?
Yes, I was watching when it ended. You could just hear the whole clubhouse be like, ah.
All right, let's describe the play. David Peralta, again, top of the eighth. So we're through seven. And through seven, okay, so no hitter, I certainly don't care until it's through seven at all. Perfect game, if you're through six, I'm paying attention. Yeah. So once you're through seven, we're in range, right? Okay. David Peralta against Drew Smyly. Not exactly the best matchup for David Peralta. And he just tapped. I mean, broken bat, right? Broken bat dribbler, effectively a perfect bunt. Probably one of the most beautiful bunts you'll ever see. And I think a big part of this, I'm curious, Jake, give us your PFP take on what happened in this play.
So it's a really difficult play to make. If you're a lefty thrower, it's a lot harder to make. The ball was hit to the third base side. If you're a right-handed pitcher, you can pick up the ball. You're facing the catcher. You're seeing the catcher. You're picking up the ball with your right arm, and you're already facing the correct way to throw it to first base. If you're a lefty, you are taught to spin around, right? You're taught to kind of pick the ball up with your left hand as you're turning with your back to the catcher and spin and fire to first. And that was the problem here because Drew Smyly did not see Yan Gomes a-coming, and Gomes essentially laid him out. And that was the perfect game.
Yes, it was. Then they debate for the next, you know, half inning. Would he have made the play if Gomes did not tackle him? And Gomes seemed to clearly acknowledge, like, yeah, that was my fault. Although, to your point, like, for Gomes, in Gomes' head, this is going to be an easier play for me to make, right? Because I'm running towards the ball and I can just pick it up and whatever. But once Smiley committed to getting it, calamity ensued. And so that is what happened. It was, of course, it was perfect. It was the perfect kind of, it was the perfect ending to a perfect game pursuit. It was the most baseball thing that could ever happen. And it gave us one of the great screenshots and gifts, I think, of baseball goofiness that we've really seen in quite some time. And I know it sucks for Drew Smiley, but it seems like they had a good attitude about it. This was not the ninth with two outs, in which case this would be legitimately heartbreaking. Like, this was still out of the point where it was just, it's funny. It is objectively funny. It's unfortunate, but it is objectively funny.
This does not happen if it's not a perfect game, like this collision, because they both wanted it so bad that they just weren't communicating. They're like, ball, I need it, right? And the funny thing was, so the replay's playing and like some guys in the Blue Jays clubhouse are reacting to it. And George Springer goes, did they just bunt? Because he just saw the replay and was like, oh my God, they bunted the perfect game. And someone was like, no, George, it was a swinging bunt. He was like, oh, okay. You know, watching baseball players watch this was a very cool experience. I think one pitcher, I'm trying to remember who it was, yelled across the room to Alejandro Kirk and was like, don't you ever do that to me. Like, don't ever run into me like that. Like, we're going to have problems. You know, it was good banter. So good for Drew Smiley. Good for the Cubs. Good for Yan Gomes showing how bad he wants it. This is a hit. I'm watching this back now. Like, I don't think they're getting the guy first.
Yeah, no, it's close enough. Peralta running, you know, lefty batter. Like, I think it would have been close anyway, but that's why I'm glad it happened this way, right? If it's a normal, say they field it normally and he just beats it out, like, no one cares, uninteresting. But instead, here we have just one of the funniest sequences we've ever seen.
Other perfect game attempt. Eduardo Rodriguez of the Detroit Tigers yesterday against the Orioles, just carving him up. Crazy.
I was not watching this one at all. So I don't know what your experience was watching this one. Of course, the Orioles going for the sweep, and instead they were getting perfect game. But also, the Tigers didn't have any runs. So that's another unique part of a perfect game or a no-hitter attempt, is when your team doesn't have any runs, you're like, okay, so is he just going to have to go 14 or 15 perfect? Or how's this going to work? So were you watching this game?
Yeah, I watched most of this game. And the weird experience of this is knowing that the Orioles were going to win, having the confidence that even though they were getting perfect gamed through, I guess six. It was six. Like, I was like, oh yeah, they're going to win. I'm not worried at all.
Yeah.
And they won.
My experience of this game, and we've talked about this on the pod before, like, perfect games are very, I take care about them a lot because Felix Hernandez, my favorite pitcher, has the last one. And I am constantly thinking, as perfect game bids are in progress, like, do I want this guy to have the next one? And to be honest, Drew Smiley and Eduardo Rodriguez were pretty low down on those rankings. You know, Luis Castillo had one through six last week, and I was like, well, this should be pretty cool. Like, if we're going to have, you know, hand it over, like, I can't complain about this one. These two were a little bit lower on the rankings. But for Erod, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the experience of Erod throwing a perfect game against you is like, really infuriating because he's not blowing you away, right? And so if Shane McClanahan is perfect, it's like, well, we can't touch this. Erod, if he's dominating, it's just sequencing and spotting and, you know, mixing in an off speed down. And it was just guys barely missing it. He only had like six strikeouts and they were just hitting it off the end of the bat. And it was like, just hit it. It's right there. Just hit the ball. Come on.
So the other thing is that it overshadowed the Erod versus G-Rod showdown. And Grayson was awesome. And so that kind of got lost in the perfect game bid from Erod. And, you know, listen, if Eduardo Rodriguez, you know, another Venezuelan pitcher, it's been really cool to see him look good this year after the very strange season he had a year ago with a lot of off the field issues where he was away from the team. Like, it's been nice to see him kind of bounce back and look like this is what they really did pay for, right? This is the Eduardo Rodriguez that we were counting on being for the Tigers. Is it going to change? Is it going to stop the Tigers from losing 100 games? Probably not, but it is still nice to see him look like the pitcher that we did think that he was. So that has been nice. But at the same time, you know, that, you know, he ultimately loses it with Ryan Mountcastle.
It was an infuriating way for him to lose it because yeah. Mountcastle swings at freaking everything. And they had the way that they had pitched him is like they got up 1-2 and they were throwing balls like all over the world. And Mountcastle was swinging and fouling them off. And they did like two or three of them. And then they threw it in the zone and he hit it for a single. Like, yeah. just don't throw Ryan Mountcastle anything anywhere near the strike zone if it's a 1-2 count. And that's how they ended up losing it. He ends up getting pulled, and the bad Tigers bullpen ends up blowing it. After that, Orioles take the W. Let's talk about Drew Maggi, Jordan Schusterman. Who is Drew Maggi? Why is Drew Maggi relevant? And what's going to happen with Drew Maggi?
So Drew Maggi is a 33-year-old journeyman. Now, are you a journeyman if you have only journeyed in the minor leagues and you've only played for three organizations? I guess he added up a bunch. I guess he got to, Pirates, Angels, Dodgers, Guardians, Twins, Phillies.
So you are not a journeyman. You are a vagabond.
You are a pilgrim.
Yes. You're a pilgrim at that point.
Drew Maggi got a lot of attention yesterday. 15th round pick by the Pirates in 2010. But as I mentioned, he has been on five other organizations since then. Ended up back with the Pirates last year. And then this year, he's been in Double A. He has played well over 1,000 games in minor league baseball and has never been called up. He has been just your consummate utility infielder. He has, of course, played 200 games at second, 200 games at third. He's played 20 games at first, 100 games in left. He's, of course, pitched in some games. He's played 400 games at shortstop. He's played them all, right? He's basically played everywhere. He's got a career, 697 OPS. And that kind of explains to you why he has not necessarily gotten the call up to the big leagues. At the same time, this is someone
But I was going to say, but the 697 OPS also explains why he's hung around, because he's not awful.
Yes, he's not awful, and obviously he is a quality and competent defender at essentially every position. And so that is a reason to keep a guy like him around, on top of what is the other key to sticking around a long time?
Don't be a dick.
And so, especially for someone, if you're not a catcher, right? Because catchers have a higher bar, because everybody needs catchers. And so, if you can stick around as a non-catcher, you are clearly an awesome dude. And that is what Drew Maggi has been.
I love the idea of, hey, kids, if you're a dick and you want to hang around for a while, make sure you catch.
Make sure you catch. But he is, he's been in the minors forever. And what happened was Brian Reynolds went on the bereavement list, and the Pirates called him up on Sunday. Now, he was called up by the Twins in 2021 in a similar situation. He was having a good year in AAA in St. Paul, got called up for a day or two and did not end up getting in a game. This time, they called him up. And he did not get into a game Sunday. I do not know when Brian Reynolds is expected to come back. The Pirates do not play today on Monday, but they come back on Tuesday. But we just want to see Drew Maggi get into a game, because much was made about him getting called back up. There's this great video the Pirates put out of him getting the news and, of course, showing up at PNC Park. And it's all great. And it's as predictably emotional, but very cool as you would expect. And the obvious way to think is please just put him in a game. Please just let this guy be able to call himself a major leaguer. How do you feel about that? Because that's basically how I feel. That's how I think anybody feels rationally. But it also kind of reminds you that how this all works. And there's a reason he's never, you would think that at some point along the way nearly 500 games he's played at AAA, that there would be situations where it'd be hey, let's just call Drew Maggi up for a game. And yet it's only happened twice now and he still hasn't gotten into a game. Do you feel like he deserves, that he's obligated to get a plate appearance or an inning in the field? Or do you think that he needs to earn it, or the situation needs to arise?
He deserves it. I think that when you watch the video of him finding out and you listen to the way the teammates in the minors react to the news, there are gasps, right? There is clapping. There is hugging. He is clearly emotional about it. This is a player who has given his life to baseball. And that is the type of thing that baseball people respect and admire. Even though he is objectively not good by the standards of big league baseball, he has the respect of guys who are way better than him, right? Andrew McCutchen has probably met Drew Maggi 8 times. Although I guess maybe they came up together. But McCutchen must have unbelievable amounts of respect for this guy when he gets to the big leagues because of what he's been through. Ball players respect ball players who post and who grind, and he's done that. And I think that Shelton, Derek Shelton, the manager of the Pirates, is one of those guys and is going to do everything he possibly can to get Maggi in a game, like just to say that he's a big leaguer. Mm-hmm. Now, I really hope he doesn't get sent back down before their next game on Tuesday. It would be a really bad look for the Pirates to promote this entire moment of Maggi coming up to the big leagues and then they don't even get him into the game. I think Shelton cares and understands what's going on here. And again, like, is this a courtesy? Like, it's not like a make-a-wish situation, like get this guy into the big leagues. Yeah. He has earned this experience. He has been a not awful player in the high minors for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. He's a professional big leaguer. I mean, you saw the video of him finding out. Man is ripped. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, he's not some schlub off the street. I believe he was like a Team USA guy in college. Mm-hmm. Like, he's a real ball player. And given another circumstance, he's in another organization coming up the chain where a guy gets injured. Like, he totally could have been in the big leagues. And so I think he has earned it, and I hope he gets the chance.
Yeah, no, I hope so too. Just to like put in perspective his journey and how long he's been doing this. So Drew Maggi was taken in 2010, 15th round out of Arizona State. Another player who was taken in 2010 out of Arizona State in the 8th round was Merrill Kelly. Think about what Merrill Kelly's career has, how Merrill Kelly's career has transpired in the time that Drew Maggi has basically just been in Double A. And in AAA. Merrill Kelly came up with the Rays, reached AAA in 2014. And in 2014 was like, this isn't working out for me. I'm going to go to Korea for four whole seasons. Merrill Kelly goes to Korea for four whole seasons, comes back, becomes a major league pitcher, is now in his fifth season of Major League Baseball, all in the time that his college teammate has just been grinding away in AA and AAA. And now, hopefully, they will both be able to call themselves big leaguers. So we'll see what happens with that. I am a little nervous about, you know, Reynolds coming back or the roster move ending up sending him down, but I do hope that they can put him in, because that would be great.
And just to give the perspective of how long ago this draft was, this is Bryce Harper going number one overall in 2010. All right. This is Harper, Tyon Machado, Christian Colon, who's like already out of baseball, Matt Harvey. Okay, Matt Harvey was another guy who was drafted out of college in this draft. Think of all the things that have happened to Matt Harvey, the things that have happened to Chris Sale, the things that have happened to Christian Yelich. And here is Drew Maggi making his number one, or making his first appearance in the majors.
Hopefully. We will see, but still, either way, an awesome story, and we salute his perseverance. All right, Jake, I think we should end this podcast here. As always, especially in April, just another round of injuries that we got. Logan Ohapi out 4 to 6 months with a torn labrum. Garrett Mitchell looks like he's going to need shoulder surgery. Chris Bubich having Tommy John. All three of these are super disappointing injuries for young players who had very, very impressive starts to their seasons. Each of these injuries will have very differing impacts on their team's playoff odds. But the Ohapi one is a big deal, because that was one that, you know, catcher, that especially as we see Brandon Marsh has been tremendous in Philadelphia. This was looking like a win-win for both teams, and now they lose him. And that's the kind of injury that is, listen, it's not Trout or Ohtani, but Ohapi was even better than I think I expected right away. And now their catching situation becomes messy pretty quickly. I assume they're going to have to revert back to Stassi, and then probably, I guess, Matt Theis, if he's still catching.
Stassi is hurt in the timetable there.
Chad Wallach is the other one, who's, again, just, you know, obviously just a backup guy. So that definitely hurts them and sucks for who was very much going to be, you know, in the rookie of the year conversation. He's been really, really good.
Let's do an email and then we will say goodbye. This email is from Dylan Tonk Johnson. He says, hey, fella, this is an awesome email. Like, this fires me up. Hey, fellas, love the pod. The discourse about Ohtani feeling comfortable on the Angels combined with Joey Gallo's resurgence on the Twins led me to wonder what would happen if Ohtani declared that he would only go to a central team. Obviously, as a Twins fan, I have literally no hope of him signing to my favorite team, like many other teams without owners willing to spend. So thinking about his comfort made me dream of Ohtani in a small market. What do you think Stephen A. would say about Cincinnati Reds legend Shohei Ohtani? Nothing good, probably. Thanks, guys. Love the pods. P.S. Will the Twins offense please start hitting? What we're going to do, Jordan, we're going to rank the 10 teams in the AL and NL Central by likelihood that they will sign Shohei Ohtani.
So Okay. Is that how we want to do it? Because to me, I feel like the first step is like throwing money, moving money aside. But we want to make it likelihood. If all he has said, he still wants to get paid, we assume. But he has declared that these are only the 10 teams in the running.
So you're saying like forget payroll, willingness
I'm
to
just
spend.
Saying like, right. Which of these teams would Ohtani want to play for the most? 1 to 10. But let's do it like that. Let's do it like we'll follow the prompt here.
Okay. I think number one is the Cubs, and it's not close.
Yeah. Cubs are right. So Cubs, the rest of the conversation is more interesting. Okay. Cubs number one. Cubs were the only team that were on his list of the finalists of seven, the final seven teams that he had when he was a free agent last time. So the Cubs are the clear number one. So now the real conversation again, as we say, the draft starts at two.
The draft starts at two. I would say,
likelihood. Okay, let's just say likelihood. He has narrowed it down to these teams. I think my next pick still has to be the Cardinals. I think.
Yeah.
I think the Cardinals still have to be the next pick. And then I think the Twins have to be up there too. I think the Twins are probably, again, which of these teams have we seen spend exorbitantly recently? It's Minnesota.
But we're not talking about money. We're not talking about money.
But you said likelihood to sign him. So there's got to be some component of it. We have to have some sort of record of recent, giving a lot of money to a baseball player, even if it's not that much. And if that's the conversation, it has to be Minnesota. It has to be, I guess, the White Sox and then Detroit, right? Because Milwaukee has been completely disinterested in free agency entirely, as has generally Pittsburgh, certainly Cincinnati, certainly Kansas City, right? And Cleveland, to some degree. So then maybe, you know what, let's forget money, because trying to determine the difference here is stupid. We're talking about like this is irrelevant. We're already in a totally goofy reality, right? So let's say who would Ohtani want to play for, ranked them 1 to 10. I still think the Cubs are number one, but then where do we go? Do we think
I'm going to move the Cardinals down?
Okay,
because I don't know if those vibes are right for Shohei.
Okay,
so I think the Cubs are number one. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put at number two. I'm going to put Cleveland.
Okay.
I'm going to put Cleveland at two because I think he likes the drive line tech stat.
They've got the right attitude.
Yeah.
And also like he can really impact them on both sides of the ball.
And then I'm going to put Milwaukee three because he did play in a dome. In Japan.
Indoors as kind of a selling point is an interesting. I like that.
Okay, then I'll do the Twins at four. I'm gonna put the Royals at 10. Okay.
Royals
at the bottom.
Yeah, Royals and Reds probably have to be at the bottom. Again, we also have to assume Ohtani would like to win. Which is another part of this.
Oh, that's
which,
a good point.
Pittsburgh right now, make your pitch. Now's the time.
That's a good point. I'm going to put the Cardinals back up at five because he does want to win, right? Like that is the whole kind of thing here. I think because of that, you have to put Royals, Reds, and the Tigers at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to put the White Sox at six. Okay, so in order, Cubs one, Guardians two, Brewers three, Twins four. Cardinals 5, White Sox 6, Pirates 7, Tigers 8, Reds 9, Royals 10. You want to move the Pirates up, don't you?
Pirates over the White Sox.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, think about it this way. Way more fun to hit one into the Allegheny than into the nondescript seats at Guaranteed Rate.
That is true. I will say this experience, this experiment, this exercise has really confirmed for me he won't go to any of these teams.
Oh man, but I would love to be wrong. The Photoshop of him in a Pirates hat and jersey never fails to make me smile, and I would love to see it come true. Ben Charrington, that is your challenge, my friend. All right, Jake, you did it. Did a podcast. Thank you to Dylan for that fantastic email. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. Leave us a rating, a review. Let us know how we're doing. We would appreciate the feedback. You can get BBCast merch, podswag.com/baseball. Thank you to Chris Tyler for producing this episode of Baseball Barbercast. On Wednesday, we will return our attention to the A's of Oakland slash maybe Las Vegas and dive deep into the situation that is still ongoing. There's a couple already twists and turns since we last recorded, so we'll keep an eye on that. We'll have a special guest for that. But until Wednesday, enjoy the ball, and we will talk to you guys very, very soon.
We are the Pirates. Don't do anything.
SiriusXM Podcasts.